Hello and welcome to Don't Miss a Beat, presented by Inside Cardiology. Don't Miss a Beat is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Muthu Vadaganathan, and my co-host, Dr. Stephen Green, providing a regular news roundup of the latest evidence and clinical trial insights across cardiorenal metabolism. Hosted by practicalcardiology.com, Don't Miss a Beat is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Well, welcome back to this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Muthu Vadaganathan from Brigham and Women's Hospital, and very excited about the episode we have in store for today. Now, it's a little bit of a different direction that we're taking with this episode compared with prior, and the topic today is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And the reason we are talking about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, because there's really been a major therapeutic advance in the last several months, and then recently FDA approval as of April 28th. And the therapy we're talking about is mavacamten, a first-in-class cardiac myosin inhibitor. And as mentioned, this was approved by the FDA on April 28th for patients with symptomatic obstructive cardiomyopathy with NYHA class 2 or 3 symptoms to improve functional capacity and symptoms. And this was based on the pivotal phase 3 EXPLORE-HCM trial, which was presented last year at the European Society of Cardiology Congress and published in The Lancet. And after a really period of really relative stagnant therapeutic momentum in this space, it really has been a major therapeutic advance for a very morbid condition that we've been hearing about and learning about for, you know, really since our cardiology training started. So with that, I'll pass it over to my colleague, Dr. Vadaganathan and Muthu. And if you just wanted to give any other further contextualizing comments, but also importantly, to introduce our very special guest we have with us today.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve. And very, very exciting time for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I feel like it's taken center stage at almost every international meeting. And we're seeing now more and more data build for to support new approaches to the management that can actually change disease course. So it's really a privilege to have Dr. Anjali Owens, who is a world expert in this space. She's the medical director of the Center of Inherited Cardiac Disease and an assistant professor of medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania. And I've had the privilege to work with her in other capacities, and it's really, really special to have you on our podcast today. Welcome, Anjali, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Muthu and Steve, for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
Perfect. So let's get started. We want to, of course, cover the pivotal trial that set the stage for this shift in the therapeutic landscape of EXPLORE-HCM. So Anjali, why don't you start us off? Could you walk us through some of the design elements of how EXPLORE-HCM was set up and perhaps the key take-home messages of the trial?
Sure. So EXPLORE-HCM, as you mentioned, is the pivotal, really landmark trial that led to the FDA approval of mavacamten. And to date, it's the largest placebo-controlled double-blinded trial that we've had in symptomatic obstructive HCM patients, enrolling about 250 patients. Most of the patients were NYHA functional class 2 at baseline, and approximately 3/4 of patients were on beta blocker therapy. The rest of the patients, the vast majority, were on calcium channel blockers. So they were on our standard guideline-directed therapy for symptomatic obstructive HCM. And they were started on mavacamten, those in the MAVA group, with an opportunity for 2 dose titrations at 8 and 14 weeks into the trial. The treatment was continued for 30 weeks prior to washout, and then the opportunity to enroll in the long-term extension study. And the trial design was interesting in that the primary endpoint was a composite looking at peak VO2 and NYHA functional class. And you could either meet the primary endpoint by getting an improvement in peak VO2 of at least 1.5 mL per kg per minute in conjunction with an improvement of at least one class in NYHA, or you could get an improvement of greater than 3 mL/kg/min in your peak VO2 with no worsening of NYHA functional class. And the study, of course, met its primary endpoint with 37% of subjects in the MAVA group achieving the endpoint versus 17% of those in receiving placebo. So the way that I see it in terms of looking at patients is the other important secondary endpoints looked at LVOT obstruction, which saw a substantial decrease in LVOT gradients in patients treated with mavacamten versus placebo. And we're talking 35 to 40 millimeter improvement in LVOT gradients. We saw improvements both at rest and with provocable gradients. And we saw a significant improvement in quality of life scores. So when you're looking at your patient in clinic and you're hoping for improvement in obstructive HCM, you got the trifecta: improved objective exercise tolerance, improved symptoms, and an improved gradient.
That's a great overview. And again, like you said, really, trifecta is a great way to phrase it. Really, the full spectrum, so many domains of benefit really seen. And, you know, again, 250 patients seems like a modest sized trial compared to some of the other mega trials in heart failure, but in HCM, you know, really a very large and well-characterized cohort here. You know, you mentioned that the quality of life data and, you know, from someone, Mutu and I have discussed, you know, quality of life both offline and on this podcast before, and the KCQ is very commonly used, the state-of-the-art endpoint for this. You know, what struck me was the magnitude of benefit in this trial, you know, more than 9-point benefit, you know, and we've talked even, you know, most recently, there's been like Chief HF and Preserved HF with SGLT2 inhibitors in heart failure. And, you know, we're talking about 4-point, 5-point magnitudes of differences, which are very large, but this is really a 9-point benefit. And just wondering any comments or perspectives on that?
Yeah, it was striking, really, the benefit that we saw in KCCQ. And I think, you know, for a disease that has a dynamic component, good days and bad days, it's often hard to capture as the clinician whether the patient is better or worse, or this is just a good day or a bad day. And to really see this data over time, where a drug, not a TAVR or, you know, surgical intervention, but a pharmacologic intervention, having this degree of magnitude of improvement of KCCQ, I think was quite striking. And really tells us that this patient population is suffering and that there are ways to benefit them that really make a difference. And, you know, I think I really like the KCCQ for HCM, and now we've shown benefit and sort of validated in this population. But even still, I think there are areas of symptomatology that aren't quite captured on KCCQ, which of course was built and sort of structured towards more of a generalized heart failure population. And there are intricacies of symptoms that we see very commonly in obstructive HCM, postprandial symptoms, palpitations, et cetera, that aren't even fully captured on KCCQ. So I think the magnitude of benefit may be even more striking.
Oh, that was wonderful perspective. And I too was struck by that breadth and magnitude of benefit in terms of quality of life. And, you know, I cannot recall a different, a prior oral therapy in a blinded experiment that showed this magnitude of KCCQ benefit. And so that's really telling to the burden of disease. And, you know, you'll recall, as you know, Steve had mentioned, that many of our other even foundational heart failure therapies offer on average few point differences in KCCQ, mostly because perhaps a portion of the population may have more substantial benefits, while the majority of patients may have stable symptom status. Here you're seeing really a shift in the overall disease burden, which is really dramatic. I'd love to discuss some of the regulatory aspects around HCM management and that, and how future trials will actually be designed. You know, heart failure has really set a very high bar for how New therapies are studied and approved and have really focused on hospitalization and mortality as the therapeutic bar needed for regulatory approval. However, HCM is a very unique disease state. And so how do you foresee in the future, we saw how the FDA handled mavacamten, how do you see the future of HCM therapies being studied? And do you think it'll continue to focus on these types of endpoints as studied in Explore-HCM?
It's a great question, Muthu, and one that we think about often as we think about how to design future trials in HCM and specifically moving from the obstructive to non-obstructive HCM population. And so we're not going to see, you know, mega trials of thousands and thousands of patients who have high mortality, high hospitalization rates, as you said. That's just not what we see in this condition. And so I think there has been an important move from a regulatory standpoint and trial design standpoint to look at feel and function. And that's really the composite endpoint of Explore was a bit of a gamble, but certainly one that paid off and that looked at both feel and function. And I think that's where we're moving and adding in also the important component of the patient reported outcomes, the PROs and the KCCQ. I think that's probably going to move toward even a greater center stage in trials to come. And rightfully so. I think that's an important perspective that we need to take into account when we're treating patients and seeing how they do. So I think it would be really hard to eventually look at survival benefit. It's not impossible. And one might imagine a larger trial design that just has to go on for longer with more patients. And maybe, you know, you would get a feel and function endpoint in a year, but then you would follow patients longer, 2 or 3 years, to really get those harder, more typical cardiovascular endpoints. And if you're looking at a sicker population, say, for example, of non-obstructive HCM, you will see a fair number of people get atrial fibrillation at least. And so then maybe you would get some of those harder endpoints, even stroke or mortality, if you go further down the line. But I think in order to get approval for novel therapeutics, maybe starting with a feel and function study and then extending it. The other very interesting question would be that if myosin inhibitors or other novel therapeutics end up actually being disease modifying, then we may be able to open up a different realm of looking at trials and studies and drugs in different ways. But again, that's as yet an unanswered question.
Well, now I want to ask you a question to kind of shift gears a little bit. So we established we have this very efficacious therapy. Now the key question is, can we actually implement this in real world practice? And, you know, Muthu and I have talked about this a lot. I think the poster child for this is HFrEF, where we have, you know, blockbuster trial after blockbuster trial. But then when you look at the real world use of these therapies, many of them even generic therapies, we have such gaps in the use, and patients that would, you know, reap enormous benefits are just not getting them. So now, you know, after a period of not having much medical therapy advancement, you know, now HCM is you know, blessed now with this highly efficacious therapy. You know, what are your, you know, what do you project, and what are any of your take-home points you think as we try to implement and roll out mavacamten to U.S. practice?
It's a great question, Steve, and one that we're grappling with now in the few weeks since FDA approval. As you know, mavacamten was approved by the FDA with a boxed warning for systolic heart failure and under a REMS program. And so that, I think, will limit, at least in the beginning, the availability of the drug to the masses, if you will. I think there will be, you know, you have to be a prescriber that's trained, you have to follow the REMS program. The patients have to sign up. So there are a few extra bars that are set in to maintain safety, which I think is very important. Of course, this is a new mechanism of action, a new class of drugs. And until we as cardiologists become accustomed with it, it's important to have those safety backstops in place. So what we've done here in anticipation of FDA approval is try to think about the logistics of how we're going to roll this out in the real world, which is, of course, much different than a clinical trial setting. And what we've decided to do is to implement a myosin inhibitor clinic where we are going to use that as our focus to do both baseline and follow-up safety echoes and staff it with physicians and or APPs who will be following the patients, looking at their echoes, examining them, and doing those monthly checks for the first 3 months as we get patients onto drug. And I think it will be a change in practice and in the community. I don't know if it'll be harder or easier, but getting, you know, multiple echoes and having multiple visits does add a layer of complexity to scheduling and to follow-up. I think the other thing that's important is to relay this information early on to the patients, some of whom may only be used to coming to the cardiologist once or twice a year to tell them, oh, by the way, in the first 3 months, you're going to have three echoes. It's a big change for them. And I think they have to understand that and be willing to partner on this in order to be able to prescribe this drug safely. I do think on the flip side, once they start to feel better, that it's going to be worth it for so many patients. And already we have many, many calls and a list of over 130 patients who are waiting to get onto this drug. So I do think it may be a game changer.
No, that's wonderful. And I'm so glad that there's dedicated efforts already underway to organize implementation of therapies, which we've so sorely lacked in other domains. I want to discuss a bit around safety because much of the reason why there's been this regulatory framework has been around potential safety risks with myosin inhibition. And as I understand it, there have been some long-term experiences, including the extension trial experience. So could you share a little bit of insight around the extension program of Explorer?
Definitely. So the long-term extension trial, MAVA-LTE, is enrolling patients both from the Explorer trial of obstructive HCM and also the MAVERICK trial, which was non-obstructive HCM. And when we look at the population of patients from Explorer who rolled into long-term extension, there are many patients who are in the study now 3+ years and doing quite well. And so overall, we have not seen any new safety concerns in the long-term extension, and that's very important. And we expect to see and did see with Explore and in the LTE, a mild, modest decrement in ejection fraction on the order of, you know, 4 to 7%, I would say, that's still well above 50%. These patients start off hyperdynamic by nature of their disease and have remained well in the normal range. That being said, there's a few individuals who can drop their ejection fraction to below 50%, and we have seen that. And so it's important to understand who those patients might be, to pick it up early, and then importantly, to temporarily stop myosin inhibitor therapy, allow time for the ejection fraction to recover, and then decide whether you're going to restart at a lower dose. And what we've seen in the long-term extension study, and much of this data will be forthcoming, is that intercurrent illnesses such as pneumonias or other, you know, intercurrent illnesses that happen in the real world can be an incidence where your ejection fraction can drop, and also periods where you may go into rapid atrial fibrillation and have changes in contractility and sort of need for cardiac reserve. And that may be another instance where the ejection fraction can drop. So I think in the real world, we have to tell our patients that if something else is going on, even if it's non-cardiac, let us know so that we can understand whether or not we need to adjust your medical therapy. And importantly, with mavacamten, there are drug-drug interactions that need to be taken into account because of its metabolism through the cytochrome system. So we need to know if patients are started on new medications or if medications are changing so that we can anticipate whether or not dosing needs to be changed.
No, those are wonderful, wonderful perspectives. And I'm going to just steal a few more minutes of your time with one more question. And as I understand it, the trial really focused on phenotypic HCM rather than the genetic subset. And how do you think that will influence how we ultimately deploy this therapy, but also seek out and identify HCM in the community? Do you think that changes things? Should we be, as for instance, general cardiologists or folks not specializing in HCM, should we be looking for more phenotypic features of HCM and then moving forward to try to get patients into therapy?
I think this is a call for the general cardiology community to recognize and diagnose HCM. And certainly the obstructive cohort or, you know, hemodynamic subtype, it's important for us to do echoes, measuring gradients, measuring accurate wall thickness. And if we have, you know, any question as to whether or not we're getting an accurate measurement, to get an MRI so that we really are identifying these patients. And so many echoes are done without an accurate measurement of LVOT gradient, and we really need to change that, use provocative measures, and really identify that subset of patients with obstructive HCM. Because as you said, in the trial, genotype negative patients responded well to the therapy, and I think that that's what we will see in the community. Importantly, we do want to be able to phenotype patients to a degree that we can exclude patients with amyloid or other storage disorders who may not have a beneficial effect with myosin inhibitors. So it's important for us to kind of look at that thick heart and understand what we think is causing it so we can best tailor the therapy. And I think that that will be increasingly important. In terms of how it might determine who we treat, I think once you're in that symptomatic obstructive phase, the therapy with a myosin inhibitor is reasonable if you have already tried our standard of care beta blocker, calcium channel blocker. I think where genetics may become important in the future is as we understand whether or not we should be starting these drugs earlier in the disease process. That's where genotype may become important. And perhaps that group of patients who are sarcomere genotype positive for pathogenic variants may stand to benefit from earlier treatment if we understand their underlying pathophysiology, their genetics, and that maybe they would benefit even before they develop very symptomatic obstruction. But again, those questions are not yet answered, and we'll need more data and more trials to answer them.
Oh, that was, we are so, so lucky to have these perspectives and insights into the, not only the current field, but also what's to come. And so we're truly appreciative, Anjali, for you joining us today on this this month's episode of Don't Miss a Beat, and covering Explore-HCM, the FDA approval of mavacamten, and the future of myosin inhibition in HCM. So remember, everyone, you can find Don't Miss a Beat on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Practical Cardiology, your home for the clinically relevant news and information impacting cardiology. And that's it for this this month's episode. Thank you so much again, Anjali, for joining us. Take care.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.